Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I'm joined today by Bradley Gerrold, news editor. How are you doing, Bradley?
Well, it's hard to describe after the past week, isn't it?
How are you actually doing? How are you feeling? Are you feeling all right?
Physically fit, robust.
Yeah, it's been an interesting week. Tiring. Ian Smith, Companies Editor, how are you?
I'm absolutely fine. Yeah, it's been fascinating, hasn't it?
It's madness.
What a time to be a journalist.
Yeah. I mean, I've worked through a number of these crises, but this one is the most interesting.
It has the whole kind of political side to it, which is just bombastic, and anything we say about that will go and will be out of date within about a minute of the podcast.
Well, indeed. I mean, I wrote an editorial a couple of weeks ago, you know, a week is a long time in politics and anything can happen, and you know, a day is a long time in politics at the moment. I mean, where do we begin? This was the week in which Britain essentially voted to leave the European Union, which is possibly the biggest thing that has ever happened in any of our lifetimes. And probably could be the biggest thing that happens throughout our entire lifetime. So who knows? But I mean, you know, it's still playing out. We have no idea what's going on.
And it might take our entire lifetime to happen.
That's true. So yeah, we've had an interesting week on the magazine. The markets went into free fall, obviously, on Friday morning when the result came out. I must admit, I rolled out of bed fully expecting to have voted for the UK to have voted to remain, and we didn't.
Yeah, it's as you say, the markets reacted in a way that showed they were a bit wrong-footed. I think, you know, there was a lot of certainty going into the final stages of the polling day.
I mean, serious certainty.
Oh, yeah,
because you
yeah.
were looking at the pound, which was strengthening quite substantially.
Equities.
You were looking at the markets, which were gaining a lot of ground.
The bookies,
which, you know, the swing had gone very, very much towards it being a Remain vote. You know, and I thought, yeah, well, you know, it's game over for the Leave case. I mean, it seemed to have lost a lot of momentum. It's the Farage poster. Is it fair to blame it on him?
Well, yeah, he was the only one standing in front of it.
That's
so,
true, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, you looked at that and you thought, actually, you know, the nation's going to look at this and think, ugh.
Yeah, absolutely. And effectively, that's what happened. The market was placed for the status quo. That did not happen. So the market reacted in the way markets react very quickly. You saw government bonds rally or yields fell and prices rose.
Same chisel.
Yeah, equities sold off very quickly. But here we sit less than a week after we found out the result, and actually the FTSE 100 is above where it started.
And the pound was always going to fall in the event of a Leave vote, regardless of what was priced in, given the kind of current account deficit that we ran.
Yeah, it had gained some ground before, so the actual magnitude of the fall looked perhaps worse than it did on the day because we'd had this big rally in expectation of a Remain vote. But anyway, it's not, you know, regardless, the pound is now weaker today than it was last Thursday. And I spoke to Algie Hall about this, our tips editor and our stock screen guru. And he, you know, he's like, well, don't get too carried away by the FTSE 100 rise because in dollar terms, you know, the market is not really that much higher than it was a week ago because of the magnitude of the fall in the pound. So I think that's an interesting thing to consider.
Couldn't agree more. And then also, don't get too carried away looking at just the FTSE 100 because, you know, a number of those stocks, in terms of if you want to look at the FTSE 100 as a reflection of what it means for the UK economy, because as we know, a number of the biggest stocks are kind of global and some of them kind of have a lot of kind of dollar generating.
So the oil majors, the big miners had a good week.
Yeah, so exactly right. So if you'd look at it now, you know, talking on Thursday, after a week after the vote, you'd say, okay, well, are we back to square one? But a number of the stocks within the index, look at the UK banks, look at the house builders, look at some of the consumer stocks, are kind of close to pricing in possibly an economic slowdown next year, possibly a recession in terms of some of the forecasts that have come out since the vote about the impact it will have on the UK, given the uncertainty over the trading relationship with the EU.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are essentially two components to the major indices, the blue chip indices in the UK, one of which is the FTSE 100, which is very international in nature, the other of which is the FTSE 250, which is always cited as essentially being much more domestic in nature. And that's had a horrible week, and that hasn't recovered in the same way that the FTSE 100 has.
No, it's recovered to a degree. I mean, there are arguments about the fact that there's probably a bit less liquidity in that market, so falls are amplified by that. But as we just said, the constituents of that index are more domestically focused than the larger brethren in the FTSE 100. That's not to say all of the companies only focus on UK PLC, because that would be incorrect to say. But you know, something like the house builders are probably almost entirely UK focused.
So let's have a look at the chart of the week on the 7 days page, and that is the biggest Brexit fallers. Up until I think it was Tuesday,
wasn't it? It was Tuesday
that we measured this to,
which was the day before our press day, so we couldn't complete a full day's sort of trade before we went to press to take it to the Wednesday. And as you see there, you've got Taylor Wimpey, Barrett, Persimmon topping the top three there. IAG and EasyJet quickly following. Then you look at banks, some more house building related stocks, and some more financials, things like Schroders, the fund manager.
Mm, indeed. And a media company, ITV, in the middle of that as well, which is interesting from our perspective too, because we've been talking about this on this podcast for a while, that we know there's been a bit of a media slowdown in the run-up to Brexit and an advertising slowdown. And I guess the worry is that that's going to continue.
You would guess that the fear with that sort of scale fall in ITV is around the sort of plus 25% fall mark in this chart, would be that, okay, yes, there's going to be a sort of schism in consumer sentiment, and therefore advertisers are not going to want to spend money trying to get people to buy their products if they really don't think they're going to do that.
Mm. Not to mention England going out of the Euros.
Yeah. Although, but I wasn't supporting them anyway. I was supporting Poland all along.
Is that because of the sweepstake?
No, it's because my wife is half Polish.
Oh, fair enough. One of the
And Italy as well, because that's who I do have in the sweepstakes. So I'm Italy, you're Belgium, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm still in there. Good. Aiden Hazard is really starting to come good.
Indeed. So that your initial goading of me on Twitter has... We're still at a bit of stalemate here.
Yeah, exactly.
Who have you got, Bradley?
Turkey.
Didn't even win worst Moving team. On. That went to Megan, didn't it? Because she had Ukraine.
That was a real kicker. Is it? It looked like I could win £6 back, but... That didn't happen.
Never mind. Hey, never mind, Anyhow, Bradley. Better luck
next
time.
We digress.
Better luck. I win these things all the time anyway.
What we did see, I was going to say, is that what's really interesting was a high activity among our kind of readers, private investors, riding to the rescue when some of these companies were falling. And it's not surprising. You mentioned some of the oil majors, but also the house builders. There was a chance to buy into high-yielding stocks at a price that you hadn't been able to do so for quite some time. So, you know.
Well, I guess, I mean, the worry is that... the idea is that Brexit, or the possibility of a Brexit, has potentially made housing less attractive as an asset class, and that house prices will fall as a result, and that will affect the earnings of these guys. And actually, something fundamental has happened, not just something sentimental. So are they the bargains that the price fall suggests they are? I mean, I guess that's the million-dollar question.
Yeah, because if you think that house prices are going to fall by a degree next year, then you're going to have to cut your EPS forecast for the house builders, which quite directly kind of puts on to the market valuation, obviously. So you can see, you could say this is just a very reasonable move. And I saw today that one of the kind of Singapore lender, UOB, which is one of the kind of main lenders to Asian investors in the London market, has suspended its loans to people, to investors from their buying a property. So while you can still say, well, the supply and demand dynamics amongst UK citizens that want to buy property are still there, there is this big question mark about the foreign flow of capital into especially London and what the ripple effect of that will be.
Okay, so for shareholders, that's bad news. Okay, that's potentially bad news. But Redrow came out very shortly after we'd got the result of the referendum, and everything looks absolutely fine.
Yeah. Well, they were talking about the weekend prior to the vote. They had people queuing in long queues. But yeah, I think Barclay Group's been hit more, but has more of a London exposure. Mm. So yes, I think this is the million-dollar question. It's very so for those investors buying in, they're well aware of the fact that we don't have visibility so much now, maybe never do, the housing market, about where prices will be next year. It's hard to tell until we get a sense of how investor sentiment's shifted. But I'm just saying, I don't think you can only look at the domestic picture.
Yeah, I mean, one thing Jonas has argued in support of the house builders as bargains, and I think you've discussed this on the Sector Focus podcast you did today. The Sector Focus, I thought this week, was absolutely brilliant, by the way. You know, really, really worth a read, because it goes through a number of these key sectors and looks at the case for whether the falls have presented a buying opportunity. Really fantastic piece. Been really popular online, actually, and deservedly so.
It's a video, actually, that we did based on that.
Oh, that's what I meant. Yeah. That's what I meant, a video. But the other thing about house prices, I think, you know, people have suggested that the foreign influx of capital into the housing market has been a bad thing anyway, in some respects, because it's prevented many people from getting on the housing ladder. So there's a weird like political dimension to this. The young people are unable to get on the housing ladder, but they're also appalled that we now have voted to leave Europe, and yet the house prices are going to get cheaper, which is something they've been complaining about for ages anyway.
I mean, for our readers, you obviously have to separate what you think is kind of best for the country, unless you have kind of some kind of ethical investment or nationalist investment strategy. You've just got to say, what do you think the effect on the market will be? But as to your point, I think that reflects why a referendum is a binary choice. So many people vote different ways for all kinds of reasons. So yes, some people may have voted because they think that a vote to leave the EU will in some ways mean, as a second order effect, that people will, there will be less competition for kind of UK properties, but many people won't have voted based on that. You know,
I'm not sure the idea
that young people are monolithic and that's what they think. I mean, I'm sure you speak to some young people, they will kind of prioritize economic security and have be accepting of foreign capital coming into the property market if it means we have kind of more sustainable economy and stronger kind of base for jobs. I don't know, but yeah, that's why I think it's hard to kind of characterize.
Also, I think as well, the house builders, from an investment perspective, their dividends are pretty well covered and pretty solid and pretty safe.
Well, I was going to say, even if there's a little slip in house prices, I mean, you know, people have been buying these shares, not necessarily for the capital growth, but for the cash.
Exactly. And also, if sterling does remain very low, then we could import some inflation, which might actually kind of counterbalance prices, possibly. I mean, inflation is a funny odd thing, but, you know, I think there are certainly reasons that you can see why the market's become a bit more bearish on house builders very quickly. But I think there are some fundamentals which maybe if you're taking a long-term view, which as we often espouse people should do, you know, they have land banks, these housing companies, and we've got great assets.
We're not exactly awash with houses in this country. And we have, you know, regardless of whether there is a slowdown in immigration, you know, I don't think, and I think Jonas makes this point, that will really affect the shortage of homes.
Especially considering on the income side, I suppose if you characterise it since the financial crisis, the house builders have done a lot of work to kind of refinance, especially at the lower interest rates that we've seen. They're in a lot better nick financially than they have been in a long time. And many of them have just kind of started to set capital return plans that run till kind of 2020. So actually, in terms of what's already been promised in terms of dividends and the kind of cash that's there to do that, these kind of cash-rich companies. So I'm not surprised that a lot of medium-cap investors have piled in.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, after the financial crisis in 2007-08, I mean, you could pick these companies up for literally pence because they were in trouble. They'd been badly run, they'd overexpanded, they were over-indebted, and, you know, it caught up with them. But different beasts today.
A bit like the banks, I suppose.
Yeah, the banks. I mean, let's talk about the banks because I guess their woes are kind of related to this fear that there's going to be an economic slowdown and actually a housing market slowdown as well.
Definitely. We've seen the domestically focused banks have been hit hardest. And a lot of the discussion about banks prior to the referendum vote was about investment banking, given the central importance of the city to our economy, and whether we would lose the kind of passporting rights into the EU, which allows London to be a kind of financial centre for Europe. And a lot of that debate was actually, interestingly enough, HSBC, the biggest bank and the most international, has been the most resilient. Standard Chartered was also resilient because what they lack is that exposure, the huge amount of exposure that Lloyds and RBS has to the domestic economy.
What about Barclays? I mean, this is a weird beast, Barclays, because it is quite international. It's probably more international than Lloyds or RBS.
Two stools.
Yeah.
That's the thing with Barclays. And that's always been the question that we've posed on this podcast and in the pages over the past year or so, is the question, you know, what does it want to be? And so, yeah, to the extent that it's an investment bank, it's obviously hurt by a UK extraction from the EU. That is bad for the city. That would be bad for Barclays. But obviously, all of that is very much in flux. There's a large amount of political uncertainty. But obviously, it has a large retail banking operation as well. So we've seen some retrenchment from Barclays, whereas HSBC, for example, is still committed to that universal banking model of providing kind of corporate banking facilities, retail banking and investment banking in lots of different geographies.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So we've been reasonably sceptical of Barclays, and because of this question about it doesn't really know what it wants to be. RBS, I think, you know, we've kind of thought for a while, there's a lot of problems there still to deal with. I mean, what are we now, 7, 8 years after the financial crisis? And I think it's still in the process of fixing itself. Lloyds was a company we were a bit more positive about. But they got bashed too.
Obviously, it's the biggest, you know, it has the biggest market share in terms of retail banking in the UK. It was always going to get hit. But also, it was one of the most bought stocks from those investors that we talked about piling in because of the returning dividend. So, yeah, the big question for Lloyds, as for the other stocks we were talking about, is what will be the extent of the hit on the market? And will we see a declining consumer sentiment as well? Is it generally going to have a reduced appetite for consumer lending as well?
I mean, let's talk about this consumer sentiment thing, because the retailers took a battering, an absolute hammering. And I think there's a couple of things at work there, Bradley. I mean, what's your view?
Well, yeah, I mean, this morning there was actually a YouGov poll which they commissioned with CEBR, and that sort of showed that consumer confidence had fallen sharply after the Brexit vote. They've obviously done a bit of a snap poll on that. That's perhaps sort of...
Well, we don't trust pollsters anymore, so
well,
who cares?
Exactly, yeah. It's also perhaps understandable given the week of news flow we've had, you know, sort of chaos in political parties and, you know, sort of uncertainty about what the vote actually means. So it's a bit understandable people are a bit uncertain. We've had for the past few months, really, quite a few companies report... definitely a soft winter.
Mm-hmm. So Restaurant Group is a really good example of a consumer-facing stock that's really been having a bit of a torrid time. A former darling.
Yeah,
as well.
I mean, Whitbread as well. I mean, you know, its trading update over the winter was not that great. Costa suffered because footfall on the high street was not very good. Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, it's very, very difficult, but I mean, the consumer landscape is changing so much, for one thing, which is a bit of a problem. You know, you're having to have a very good online presence to keep up with the competition these days. So I guess, I mean, consumer sentiment... it's been fragile already. Perhaps that's linked to kind of the stage in the economic cycle that we are. And also the fact that, you know, wages have been rising. I think that the wage growth rise more recently has been a bit pitiful. So people's wealth has perhaps been tied up with the feeling that they're quite prosperous because of perhaps their property wealth and how much their house or flat is worth. That now could be in trouble if people think that their property isn't worth as much, or they were in the process perhaps of a transaction and somebody who wanted to buy their property has now tried to undercut what they were previously offering. Yeah. That could be a key thing that hits consumer sentiment, actually.
Indeed. I mean, let's talk about Dixons Carphone. So they had a big, you know, hit to their share price.
Yeah.
It looks in pretty decent shape, their business.
It does. I mean, Harriet covers this and she did the results yesterday, I believe. And she's kept it on a buy because I think it fell now to about 11 times. And her view is that, yes, while sort of electronics are definitely a discretionary purchase, although they're becoming a bit more entangled in our everyday lives.
I don't think anyone can do without their mobile phone. It's only old duffers like me that don't care what their mobile phone is.
Yeah, but
like
everyone's
anymore.
Got one. So, you know, they don't necessarily need a new one. That is discretionary, one would argue.
Oh, I don't buy that. I think the moment the new iPhone comes out, everyone wants it.
Perhaps.
Currency is a big problem here, isn't it? Potentially.
Yeah, I guess so. But I do think consumer sentiment's a problem. And I think that... as I say again, what I think is a problem is that electronics as a broad church are a discretionary item. Mm-hmm. And so Dixon's car phone could suffer if people don't want to start buying the latest thing.
Yeah. Not to mention, and I completely agree with everything you've said, and the results we did cover this week, and the like-for-like sales were up 5%. So, I mean, it's in the actual business, the organic strength of business is very good. But they also do have European operations, both inside the European Union, and they also have a Norwegian operation, which is inside the European Economic Area.
So is this a problem or a good thing?
I think I think people are still trying to work that out, but it's potentially a hurdle, isn't it? If the UK then extracts itself from the EU, and the fact they have operations in both places might help them, might hurt them, but it depends on how the relationship is actually set.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I don't understand. I mean, it's not like a drawbridge is being pulled up and, you know, any British company that's operating out in Europe can no longer operate there. I mean, I don't get this. I mean, this seems...
But we don't know the level of tariffs, and we don't know... how that's going to be set up.
But we know what WTO says. So we know there is a kind of max.
As a sort of kind of comparison here, in answer to the question about is having an operation in Europe a good thing or a bad thing, interestingly, EasyJet has a Swiss operating license. And so for it kind of, you know, although it has no idea, like the rest of us, what will happen, won't there be trade barriers, will we be able to fly freely, whatever, it has a license to fly from Switzerland across the whole of Europe. and it has a UK license. So that could, if things don't go very collegiately, be a good thing.
Okay, yeah. So let's talk about
Dixon's car phone. That could be the same thing.
And also, they just a small final thing to finish there is that they source some of their goods from the US. So they do get hit by the kind of dollar pound thing. So there's a few different, I think, which makes it quite difficult for our readers. So a few different factors going on.
It always seems there's so much going on, it's almost impossible to triangulate. And I would suggest, maybe wrongly, but you know, my view would be, when there is so much uncertainty, when there's so many moving parts that you can't work it out, the tendency is to overreact. So actually, this could be bargain territory for some of these companies. That's certainly what we think about Dixon's.
Absolutely. On 11 times, for a very robust group that has, as Ian pointed out, you know, like-for-like sales growth in a sort of patchy consumer market is good. Yes, we don't know if that's going to persist or the growth in like-for-like sales will absolutely keep going through the roof or anything, but it's a robust business, and the merger of the two entities very recently kind of creates a bit of scale that may well end up being very useful.
Yeah, I mean, let's go back to EasyJet quickly, because they were probably the first company to come out with a warning after.
They were beaten by IAG down the runway, actually.
Oh, were they? Yeah. Okay, fair enough.
IAG.
As usual. Let's talk about EasyJet, because I think it's quite interesting, because they warned on profits quite quickly after we knew the result of the vote. There was a mention of Brexit in the profit warning?
There was.
Was this a case of, you know, the classic burying bad news type thing?
Well, one analyst I spoke to who didn't want to be named saying that said basically that you know, Brexit could well be used as an excuse for companies to get out some bad news. And this comes back to something I said earlier, that the stage in the business cycle, consumer sentiment, you know, Brexit weighs on these things, potentially, and it could be convenient for companies to say this is a problem. But with EasyJet, there are far more tangible reasons why it's issued a profit warning.
Those mainly air traffic control strikes in France.
Yep,
which I have in the past been caught right in the middle of. I must have told you my story of taking 6 days to get home.
You
after
did, it. Which is just crazy.
I told the story a million times. It was great. I got a long holiday. It's brilliant, but it cost the EasyJet a lot of money because they had to pay for me to be put up in, you know, accommodation for another 6 days.
Exactly.
As long as all the other costs they have to deal with.
Precisely. You and plane loads of other people as well.
Exactly.
The number of cancellations they've had has been just remarkable, and they've had weather-related cancellations as well. There's problems at Gatwick because apparently there's a pothole in the runway, and that's causing sort of...
What? Okay, fair enough.
So that's causing issues at Gatwick in terms of getting planes off the ground quick enough.
So surely they could fix it.
Well, I spoke to Martin Walker at Investigo Perpetual, a fund manager, and he said exactly the same thing. Like, have we not heard of tarmac in this country?
I'm sorry. I'm just flabbergasted by that latest revelation. But, yeah.
Basically, what I'm trying to say, there are tangible reasons why EasyJet would issue a profit warning. Coming back to Brexit, the fall in the pound does create an issue for it, because it will, as it said, mean costs rise for it. But it does earn a lot in euros, so there is potentially a benefit or a counteract to be sort of found there. So I'm kind of remaining bullish on EasyJet. I think that it is oversold, and I think that I have some sympathy with the view of Martin Walker from Invesco, who says that he sees this as much like a strike or a terrorist event, in that it will hit, it's very likely to hit demand in the short term. But we are a nation of travellers. Far more Brits holiday out to Europe than vice versa, and he thinks that on balance that is going to be an enduring thing. Therefore, to buy IAG, which I think Liberum, which has moved it to a hold, said it's at one of its lowest ratings possibly ever or for a very long time. You know, I think for a long-time investor, that's quite a good entry point. It's not going to be a straight line back up, and consumer sentiment is likely to be hit by this.
I've seen it before. We've seen it before. You know, exactly. I mean, I was working in a broker when the planes hit the Twin Towers. I mean, you know, travel stocks and airline stocks were the most battered, and they've come back. And actually, EasyJet, got battered when I got stuck in France, because obviously that had an enormous effect on its profits at the time. But it's a much better business now than it was then. And I think, exactly, you know, that actually helped them to refocus their business at that point.
Yeah,
nothing you can do about air traffic control strikes in France, though.
There's not, no. And that might endure and be a big problem. But EasyJet has increased the amount it kind of has in terms of business travel, which is important. Yes, you could say that might wane in the wake of Brexit, but again, it will come back. It will endure. The world needs the trade. And IAG, you know, its recent purchase of things like Aer Lingus, its budget airline Vueling, which it kind of got as part of the purchase of Iberia, those are important factors as well, and they potentially help IAG with that sort of that trading down that might happen.
All right. Well, it sounds generally positive. This is good to hear.
Yeah, it's. I think people might think I'm barking mad, but I think I don't know.
Who would say that, Brad?
Well, a few
not
people.
Not to your face.
Yeah, exactly. Just behind my back. But I think I do have sympathy for those views that tourism will endure, and the valuations the airlines are on now make it a compelling entry point.
Yeah. No, interesting stuff. I mean, you mentioned there that one of the headwinds that EasyJet is likely to face is the cost of oil, cost of fueling its planes. So, you know, let's have some good news this week, because the cost of oil is behind one of the positive stories of the week, and that is that our big oil majors have done really well this week.
Yeah, we've written a piece in the news section by Alex Newman, and BP and Royal Dutch Shell had a remarkable week, actually. They've risen an awful lot. At the time of going to press, BP was up about 8% and Royal Dutch Shell was up about 12%. This morning, it could well be even more since the Brexit vote. There are a couple of reasons for this, I suppose. A, they're very, very big companies. That helps. So they're pretty seen as pretty robust. They're internationally diverse.
Dollar earners.
Dollar earners is the key thing on the coming back to the currency thing, the point of the reason for talking about these companies. They are dollar earners, so effectively that is a positive when you translate those dollar earnings back into pounds if the pound has fallen, which it has.
Absolutely. I mean, and actually, I mean, you must have, looking across the results and, you know, what we've heard this week, dollar earners have been in demand. I mean, so the pharma has had a good week, big pharma.
Yeah, you can just see private investors looking for a natural hedge. You know, we don't, as you've said, know the ins and outs of how this is going to affect all different sectors. We have our early conclusions of what the market's telling us, but a pretty straightforward thing to do is to say, well, actually, shall I get some more kind of dollar stocks in my portfolio?
Do you know every share I own is up this week?
I was waiting until you would bring this up.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, they've had a bit of a rough ride beforehand, though. It's
But I guess, I mean, like Ian says, that hedging nature of some stocks, things like Diageo, I looked at before we came down to the podcast, has done well in the wake of Brexit. The tobacco stocks. Yeah, tobacco stocks have done well.
Is that because all the traders have just been turning to drink and fags to help themselves through this tumultuous time?
It might seem
like they haven't.
Bit.
If you look at Greene King's results, right? Yeah, actually, it wasn't you that covered it. It was a colleague, Emma Powell. I would have thought, you know, in the uncertainty running up to the EU referendum, people were not hiding in the pub, so perhaps they will be now. You know, now. But
it's going to go back to the football thing, though.
Yeah, and I think that's not great for them. A lot of the pub groups have made quite a big push around the Euros.
I mean, it's tremendous. Yeah. Every time we have a major football tournament, pub groups are usually the ones that are in the spotlight, because, you know, it's all about how far will England go and will this mean that people spend a few more quid in the pub. No one's talking about it now.
Well, maybe
is it because England is so dismal, or because this event has just overshadowed everything? I mean, I think it's a bit of both,
but Wales are still in it, you know. When is that game, actually?
I don't know,
maybe it's tomorrow. But yeah, I think going back to what you were saying earlier, John, I think it's really interesting, this idea of the Brexit excuse, because we're going to be seeing a lot more of that. And it's something I wrote about a bit this week. I actually think there is more grounds for the Brexit excuse now than there was before the referendum. We had a lot of companies citing kind of pre-referendum uncertainty. And I put a bit more stock in it now. I think if you look at what Chris Dillow's written this week, the IOD, the Institute of Directors, saying that kind of one in three people responding to a survey said they would now pause business investment. And I think one of the uncertainties for me is what will the impact be on business investment. I think that's what we kind of don't know, and that will feed in hugely into all these things we're talking about in terms of what the economic pitch will be for next year, and how concerned we should be about our kind of bank stocks and all that.
I mean, a point Chris has made for a while, though, is that business investment has been kind of depressed for some time anyway. Yeah. So, I mean, God, how much more depressed can it get?
Well, exactly. And he also makes a really good point around, we've had this big fall in the pound. Will it lead to, you know, a big rise in inflation? Well, he thinks actually it's going to be more of a hit on margins, because he thinks UK companies are still going to try and price to market with the rest of their European competitors. So obviously that we've seen European companies suffer because they think, you know, their margins might be squeezed by the kind of UK price setting. So, yeah, I think we can't just say there's going to be a mechanical effect. And he actually makes the point that the relationship relationship between the sterling and inflation hasn't been as kind of clear as people would have said in, you know, in some areas of economic theory about the, how tight that relationship is.
Yeah.
So I don't think we can really make any of these too much of these statements about what the falling pound will definitely mean for inflation.
No, I think it's still a lot of wait and see here. But I, you know, but equally this wait, this, you know, this fact that we even today after we know the result are unclear about what the future has in store. You know, the idea that you could predict with any certainty what either result would mean afterwards, I always thought that was pretty specious beforehand anyway.
Yeah, but without letting it descend into a political discussion, no. I do agree with you. I do think that's something about the nature of referendums in terms of you have people on the Leave side of the argument and the Remain side of the argument who all have very different views about how they would, you know, like to run the country in the event of their vote. So we haven't had, and some people have been very critical of, a plan for Brexit because there were different parties on that side of the argument with very different views about how they would run the economy. And obviously this is all developing as we speak in terms of the leadership race for the Conservative Party,
which is the most amazing thing I've ever seen, except for the leadership race for the Labour Party, which is going on simultaneously, which is,
well, it hasn't just, actually technically started
well it
yet.
Hasn't technically started, but it kind of has, but yeah. It's just mental. I've never seen politics like this in this
on
country.
Both sides of the house. Yeah,
got the talk. I mean, to be fair to the Conservative Party, you know, despite what you mentioned, Ian, that, you know, this this kind of division in about exactly which way we should proceed. And Farage seems to have been booted into touch here, which I don't think anybody could say is a bad thing. Whether you supported Leave or Remain, Farage being booted into touch can only be a I saw his speech in the European Parliament. Yeah. It's incendiary and pointless.
He's had his 17 years in the limelight. I think it's time for him to just sit in the pub now and not talk and sit in the pub.
Well, I actually heard, you know, one of their big backers, a guy called Aaron Banks, had said, we're going to kind of change this party now, and Nigel might not be at the head of it.
Well, so. The fact is, I mean, when you get away from a referendum and the kind of groups that that can promote, and you get back to our constituency-based democracy, they have almost no influence within Parliament.
No.
They got very close in the kind of northern constituencies, and were they to run in a general election again this year, we know that people within the Labour Party are very scared about how UKIP, how powerful they could be. But as things currently stand, their voice in Parliament is very small. So, yeah, it's not surprising that kind of UKIP get pushed to the sidelines, and I'm sure they'll reconstitute as some kind of voice of the working class party, kind of powering for them and living up to people's expectations about what leaving the European Union would be.
Mm.
And that would be a threat to Labour big time.
I think Labour should be worried. I think they
and that underlies what's going on now in their Labour, their leadership furore.
So, you know, we don't talk about politics usually, but we can talk about it objectively because it is so fascinating. You know, what we need now, I would suggest, is some kind of clarity on where we might be going. And as soon as we get a new Prime Minister, I think we will start to get that.
Yeah, I think the first step is surely like, okay, this is what we want, which isn't even clear yet.
No.
Once we have that, then we can discuss it with Europe. And then once we're in the discussion, we can kind of get a bit of a better idea of the lay of the land. And hopefully that might sort of reaffirm some business confidence possibly, or it might not. But yeah, you're right. We just need that first step, which I suppose will come after the sort of machinations of Westminster.
But Boris is out. Ruled himself out, not surprisingly, really. I mean, his position had become untenable. Michael Gove has put his name forward, although I keep seeing him and occasions upon which he has maintained that he is not a man who is fit to be Prime Minister. From his own mouth.
He's just very loud. He's just modest, John. He's just modest.
Oh, God.
Are people not allowed to change their mind if they believe it to be in the national interest?
Yeah, I think you're giving him far too much credit there. So, I mean, you know, we talked about, yeah, surely, and you're a bit nervous about using that word, Bradley, but Theresa May's looking like a shoo-in, really.
Well, as we said upstairs, shoo-ins are a strange thing.
But
now.
She likes her shoes, that's what I mean.
the key thing is that the key challenge for her, obviously, is that she was on the Remain side of the argument,
yeah,
although not vocally. She got fairly quiet,
smart.
But there's enough photos out there with her on it that you know, in terms of rallying that vote, yeah, the Conservative Party just has to decide what kind of party it wants to be. Does it want to stay a one nation party? Especially given the challenge of kind of retaining Scotland as part of the union and all of these things. But I think why this is really important for kind of our readers and the economy, obviously, is that there are many different things being said about from UK politicians about the nature of the relationship they want with Europe and the kind of things that, that we would want to negotiate prior to kind of triggering the Article 50 and starting the formal process of separating ourselves. And what is coming from the kind of senior ministers in Germany and France and the key European Union countries around, well, we won't actually start that negotiating process until it's triggered. And you're going to have this kind of shadow boxing that's going to happen after we choose who our next, or after the Conservative Party choose who the next Prime Minister is going to be.
But then you're hearing mixed messages from the continent as well.
So, exactly.
You know, you've heard like, we won't, there's no room for cherry picking from Merkel, but then you've heard the French finance minister saying everything's on the table. So, I mean, you know.
We don't know. The thing is, businesses are saying, if you heard David Cameron yesterday at Prime Minister's Questions, he was kind of saying things like, yes, we would want access to the single market. Then elsewhere, he would say, yes, we would want a close relationship with the single market. I mean, even obviously, he's not going to be around to run the show.
His mind's elsewhere, I think.
His mind's elsewhere. And obviously, we can't blame anyone for using different bits of language within kind of a 2-hour kind of question and answer session. But at the same time, businesses are going to be listening very closely to hear what is, if, say, Theresa May becomes the Prime Minister, what exactly is she going to try and negotiate from our European Union partners and things? And if it is access to the single market, but without freedom of movement, that is something that they have been categoric that they will not accept. So yeah, it'll be quite a climb down for Germany and France, and especially France, given their own domestic political context.
Someone somewhere's got to climb down.
Yeah, so
I mean, it's going to be embarrassing for somebody. So,
yeah, yeah.
But it's fascinating. We've strayed far too far into politics. It's not what we do. But I don't know, seriously, the most fascinating week to be a financial journalist, I think, ever.
Quite possibly, in a long time. And we've got an extra page in news this week for listeners who are thinking about, if they don't get the magazine, who are thinking about getting it, we've devoted a lot of space to the Brexit debate and hopefully try to bring some sort of illumination onto what we kind of think will be the actual impact on sectors now and whether there's any real value there to be had.
Well, yeah, we've got 20 pages throughout the magazine, whether it's from the fund section, the personal finance section, or sectors, you know, looking at it on a really stock by stock basis, some economic thinking from Chris Dillo. Mr. Bearble has written possibly one of my favourite pieces that he has ever written.
Wow.
This week. Yeah, I loved it. I mean, it's really talking about what we were voting against in the UK. What the electorate in aggregate has voted against.
The 52%.
The 52%. It's not the EU itself, but the after effects of globalisation and how this has created such massive income disparity. It's something I touch on in my editorial. I do think, you know, this is a, you know, whatever you think of the result, this is a great moment for politics in general, because I think it's just a reset moment. We need to have a rethink about what's been going on for a long, long time. And this is a great opportunity to really, you know, get the old whiteboard out and have a think about how we want the future to look.
It's like the end of Fight Club.
I have seen Fight Club.
All the tower blocks have fallen.
Yes, of course.
Just press the reset button.
Yeah, well, I don't want it quite like that.
Yeah. Okay, well, you know, well, it's not up to you now. The wheel is in spin, as they say.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm no Tyler Durden, but yes, I know what you want. But no, I think this is a wonderful moment. I really do. It's just a really good time to think. Bearble concludes his article with some fantastic common sense advice on how you cope with moments of stress like this. I mentioned in my editorial that, as I said, my shares are up. They're defensive. That's one way to not have to worry about things like this. James Norrington, our colleague who is more interested in things like asset allocation, his portfolio is up this week.
I think as well, if you look at the private investors, the platforms, seeing people like Hargreaves Lansdowne, Tierney Best Invest, in terms of funds, they were mentioning the likes of Woodford, very defensive. Mm. Terry Smith buys those big global companies whose consumers are people who are making just small repeatable purchases like Colgate. Then, you know, people are going to buy toothpaste, pretty much whatever. Those sorts of people, the funds have done pretty well.
Yeah, absolutely. So my view is, you know, have a plan, stick to it. You know, and my plan would generally be buy quality assets that pay dividends, reinvest those dividends, stick to it over the long term, don't overtrade because that costs you money, and you will do okay. You barely need to touch a portfolio.
And buy an Investors Chronicle digital and print subscription.
Absolutely. Well, you can't go wrong with that. I mean, you know, Ian, if there's one thing you've kind of come out of this week thinking, this has changed my thinking, or this has reinforced my thinking in some way, I mean, what would it be? I've put you on the spot here, but...
I don't know. I think that it's too much in flux at the moment to say this has reinforced or changed my thinking very much. I think the way I'm reflecting on it is just reading through our company's writers' analyses of what management is saying. And I think there is a fair amount of concern. I mentioned that IOD thing around business investment. There's a lot of divergence in terms of what people are forecasting for what the economy will do next year. And I think one of the things I suppose I've come out of it thinking is, if you don't believe the housing market is going to fall, if you think that those fundamentals are there, it's quite an interesting time for some of these really popular stocks amongst our readers. So I just wonder, if I was going to be a contrarian, I possibly wouldn't be as pessimistic about the property market.
But to believe that, you've got to take a bit of a Gove approach and say, as you mentioned in your column, and say, experts, what the hell do they know?
Yeah, exactly. And well, I suppose what we haven't had from the experts, what's actually going into those models yet? And wait, I'd say wait until the autumn statement, potentially, when we get the OBR figures and the forecast, because there's all matter of number of things in terms of how this is going to affect our economy. And there's things like, well, we mentioned the banks, the fact that the Treasury forecast the income it's going to get from selling off its RBS stakes and its Lloyds stake. Well, that can't happen. And they forecast income from that. Mm. So the state of the public finances, we're going to have to wait until the autumn statement to get a sense of actually where we are with that. And at that point, we'll get the kind of OBR forecast.
You have to remake your podcast then on Lloyds. It's brilliant. It's the gift that keeps on giving.
Well, every time people talk about the Lloyds share sale, we can just republish it. Well, it still exists. You don't even have to republish it.
Excellent. Wonderful.
Yeah, go and listen to it for free.
Bradley, key learnings of the week.
From an investment perspective, I think... I kind of agree mostly with Ian. I think that in terms of if one is out there looking and wondering what to do, you know, to add to their share portfolio or augment an existing position, the house builders seem a compelling opportunity to me. We all want and need houses. That is not going to change. The airline stocks, I mean, I can understand some listeners thinking I'm a little bit... optimistic in the short term, and I'd probably be inclined to agree with them, but I just think in the long term, you know, business travel, consumer travel, it will endure, it will remain, and I can't, if we're in a world where British Airways is disappearing, then a lot of other things will be as well. So I think some of the travel stocks have been very overhit, and banks, I mean, Lloyds and, well, RBS maybe for shares for your grandchildren, because one day they'll rise.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think... RBS at half book price or whatever it was, and Lloyds, you know, returning to the dividend roster. Yes, there are going to be problems in the short term, and there may well be in the long term if we have a really acrimonious relationship with Europe. But as you say, you have to buy on weakness. And
RBS is still 80% owned pretty much by the taxpayer. So if you don't think that bank is going to collapse, that it's pretty cheap at the moment.
Exactly.
But, you know, it's a big call. It's brave. What about you, John? What's your lesson?
Well, my lesson is, you know, as I say, I have a plan, stick to it. But, you know, I like defensives. I would always have a very solid core portfolio. And, you know, and bargain hunt around the edges. I think, you know, if you've got a bit of spare cash, you know, now's the time to be having a little punt, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. I think some of these stocks are probably that. I mean, more in terms of a spectrum, the travel stocks are the greater punt. Then I would put banks in the middle and house builders at the slightly less edgier punt.
I mean, biotechs took a battering. You know, I think, yeah, biotechs on the basis that, you know, UK science funding is about to dry up, because, no, it's not going to happen. You know, these companies, if they've got something good, you know, it will endure. It will come through. So, you know, anything that's been really badly battered, I would be looking at thinking, potential opportunity here. I really would. But, you know, I'm a cautious guy, so I would always stick to the principles of, as I say, you know, diversification and having a slightly defensive mindset and reinvesting dividends. That's the way you invest. That's the way you invest. If you don't need to take any income out of the companies you buy, reinvest the dividends. And if you've got 20 or 30 years, which I hope that we all have, you know, time will do the work for you. Time, and, you know, bouts of market weakness are exciting for us, but they're also wonderful opportunities.
This is like opportunities. It's like FDR's fireside chat instead of the president. It's John Newman reassuring the finance industry and the stock market investor that things are going to be all right.
Man. I guess it does speak to a serious point that you've only lost money in the past week if you sold. And that is true. And I think a lot of financial advisors that I've seen on Twitter have been saying just that. Like, yes, the falls were great. Yes, billions are wiped off of the stock market. But you only lost if you sold. Yeah. So if you didn't sell and you left yourself invested in the FTSE 100, a week later, you're actually up.
Indeed. I think this is my fourth major sell-off, like major sell-off, you know. You kind of get a bit immune to them after a
while. Battle-hardened.
Yeah, got 1,000 yards there. Anyway, okay, fantastic. Well, I think that's good. We've got a lot of ground there. But there's loads in the magazine this week, absolutely loads. We haven't even touched cover feature, which is really interesting. It's about some of the things you can look at, and then some of those are related to actually global trade. So these are going to be very pertinent indicators in the months ahead. It's about secret signals. It's things like container, you know, shipping rates and levels of garbage, believe it or not, actually are a good stock market indicator. Really fantastic. We've got plenty in the personal finance and funds section on Brexit as well. Actually, Leonora Walters' PF Matters piece, I really like the headline, Do Nothing. And I think that's the point we're making. You only lose if you sell. And actually, you know, tinkering is what the industry wants you to do sometimes, because that's how they make their money.
If you talk to wealth managers at times like this, they tend to sit on their hands. And, you know, perhaps top up, but generally you don't make investment decisions at times of high volatility.
Yeah, indeed. Absolutely. So anyway, thank you, Bradley. Thank you, Ian. And thank you to the whole team this week. I think everyone's done a great job under what have been pretty trying circumstances, really. So emotions have been running high. We don't all agree in the magazine. So we've been trying to get this out while we've been arguing furiously with each other as well about what the future has in store. Secret Signals is the cover feature. But obviously, I think Brexit is probably what most people are interested in this week. And when you're bored with Brexit, we've got some nice reading material in there as well. Anyway, thank you very much. Pick up the magazine, all with newsagents, £4.70. And obviously, if you like what you read, go and subscribe. Thank you very much, and we'll catch up again next week.
Shopify helps you sell at every stage of your business. Like that, let's put it online and see what happens stage.
And the site is live.
That we opened a store and need a fast checkout stage.
Thanks, you're all set.
That count it up and ship it around the globe stage.
This one's going to Thailand.
And that, wait, did we just hit 1 million orders stage? Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen.